The secrets of open source at Microsoft. 10-year-old Twitter will stick to 140 characters, or will they? And how much will you pay for PlayStation VR? All that and a lot more on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1473, recorded Friday, March 18th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/TNT and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/TNT.
And by ScoreBig. Pay less for quality seats to your favorite sporting and music events. Go to scorebig.com, click on the microphone, and enter promo code TNT to save $20 off your first ticket purchase.
And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/TNT to apply for a loan now. Hello, and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about open source and closed source and Twitter. And
everything in between things. Sourced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With people who love to talk about technology.
True.
I am Megan Maroney.
And I am Jason Howell. I love to talk about technology.
Mm-hmm. It's a good thing you do.
Especially when today's guest is on. Liberty Madison, that tech girl. How's it going, Liberty?
Fantastic. How are you guys doing, Jason and Megan?
We are doing awesome. Even better now that you're here. LibertyMadison.com or, as you know, most people know by now, hashtag that tech girl pretty much everywhere, right?
That's correct. That's correct. And also Twitter, because that's, you know, that's where I'm, if you can see the shirt.
Wow.
Liberty Madison. There you go.
Maybe covered by the lower third there. But we saw it on the wide shot. And yeah, you are like the master of the social networks, I have to say.
This shirt is a shirt that I will wear. I don't want to paint myself in a corner here and say I'll wear it every time I'm on Twit. But this shirt came about thanks to Leo Laporte. So okay. I'm very thankful about that. So
excellent.
He knows what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. And he knows how to do country line dancing because you also taught him that.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that you can find on Twitter.
I think that was a first.
Probably. I'm guessing it probably was a first on Twitter.
But not the last. All right. Well, speaking of Twitter, we should get started with our stories. In a sigh of relief heard around the world, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey has announced that the company will not get rid of the 140 character limit on tweets. Speaking on the Today Show, Dorsey told Carson Daly and Matt Lauer that the 140 character limit allows for of the moment brevity. So I watched this segment. It was quite interesting. He made some other points. His mom's favorite person to follow on Twitter is the Pope. And also he said that he likes making money when the Kardashians tweet.
I thought you were just going to stop with making money.
That is the reason to own Twitter. Yeah. The number one reason I own Twitter is the Kardashians.
Yes. Well, it was sort of that Matt Lauer question. He's like, well, you make money every time she tweets. And he's like, yes, I like that.
Yes. Yes, I do. I do. So, Liberty, as far as keeping a social network like Twitter to 140 characters, a characteristic that really has over the years defined the social network and kind of, you know, compared to the rest, it's one of the only networks that really does this. Think it's a smart move, or were you kind of hoping for a broader opening of the update limit?
Well, you know, I'm a bit biased. I am coming to you live from a Twitter shirt. So
that's true.
Yes, I'm a bit biased on this. And I just had this conversation at GDC the other day, and we were talking about what social networks are really relevant in a particular space. And someone actually had the nerve to say, you know, Twitter's not that relevant, and I don't see them going anywhere. And they're just, you know, and I go, oh, my God, that couldn't be further from the truth. And for me, I am a strong believer in Twitter. I love everything that's going on over at Twitter. And when they brought up before that they may expand the 140 characters, I thought, oh, my gosh, that is the worst mistake ever. That is the worst pivot. That is terrible. So to hear that Jack has definitely said, hey, we're sticking at 140. That solidifies Twitter's history. And I think that solidifies the platform because we already are getting used to the new changes, the new algorithm changes of it showing us how our tweets are presented to us. And that kind of caused a little uproar a couple of weeks ago. And I think that to me was a great move on their part. So A plus for that. But definitely keeping at 140 is where we need to be, because one, people are going to Twitter for relevant, current, active, live news. And that's all you need to say is a few sentences. It doesn't need to be a soliloquy. We can go to Medium for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I think he never really said that they were going to release the character limit. I think he had this, remember he tweeted with a note. It was like a screenshot of a note.
Yeah, which a lot of people do in order to go past the 140 character limit.
Yeah, so I think he was maybe saying that they would leave room for that. Like Facebook has their special notes, or I think it's called notes, where you can have it look better than just a Facebook post with no like hard returns or with all hard returns. So yeah, I think, I don't know that they're not going to allow for some adjustment there, but it sounded like, yeah, they're never going to let anyone, you know, let everyone just type whatever they want.
But in that regard, so when Jack Dorsey is actually releasing pretty relevant notes to the public and the press on Twitter using a screenshot of a block of text, and then they say they're sticking with 140, they're basically saying that this is an effective way to do that, to just take screenshots of text. But is it? I mean, I always kind of felt like it was a hacky way. Now, mind you, I actually do really like the 140 character limit. I think brevity is good, and it's one of the things that I enjoy about Twitter. Sometimes it can be a big pain in the butt because what I want to say is not easily pared down to 140 characters, but that's kind of the beauty of it. But I don't know, the taking a picture of a block of text just seems in some ways just hacky and limited. So I don't know where I stand.
Well, I mean, when they introduced the quote tweet, I think that was key because you can. And for me, I have taken a picture, not just of, a different block of text, but actually of a tweet. And then I quote that particular tweet and you can, you know, get more characters that way. But you're right. It's a hack. But I think that it is definitely imperative to that particular platform to stay on that route. Maybe someone will come up with a better hack or a different hack. Maybe Jack will in the future. Who knows? But as long as it stays at 140, I think that's the key.
Yeah.
So I know you use Snapchat as well, and we talked about that last time you were on. But would you say that there is a definite place where you would use Snapchat versus Twitter and Twitter versus Snapchat?
Well, you know what? I think that's an interesting question. Can you compare them, Twitter versus Snapchat? For me, Snapchat is definitely an area where you are pushing information and a limited number of people are able to receive it and retrieve it later. And I think the main thing with Twitter is that it's going out to the masses and they can receive it at any time and it's not necessarily deleted. I know a lot of people don't like Snapchat for that particular fact, but there is a place for Snapchat and there is a place for Twitter. You don't have to compare them between the two. The really cool thing about Snapchat, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook is they all target separate markets and separate needs. Mm-hmm. So I think that they're in their own separate categories.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like my family, my dad uses Twitter, my mom uses Facebook, my sister uses Instagram, and my daughter uses Snapchat. And that's
there you go.
And my husband uses nothing, so I have to communicate with him in the real world.
You need a combining,
which I guess is the way it should
combining
be.
Force of social networks, like a Voltron of social networks.
Yes, yeah.
To come together and save you.
Yeah.
Shifting gears a little bit here, when it comes to gaming, the demands of 4K are enormous. Throwing enough pixels to fill an HD 1080p screen like the current crop of gaming machines is relatively easy when you consider that a jump to 4K means that times 4, of course. That kind of resolution in gaming requires better hardware than Sony's PS4 currently has, and that right there might be a big reason behind today's rumor from Kotaku that Sony is working on an interim upgrade to the PS4, tentatively and very unofficially named the PS4.5. I doubt that's the real name. Pretty positive it's not the real name, but it really seems like possibly the jump to 4K. Also, when you consider upgraded hardware in a gaming machine, you know, you're going to get some of those extra visual effects, hopefully, but timed maybe even with the PlayStation VR. This could be kind of a boost that'll help with PlayStation's VR. I don't know. Are you much of a gamer, Liberty? Does any of this speak to you, sing to you?
You know, it sings to me based on the 4K aspect, because I never really understand 4K. I get it because, you know, it's a great marketing tool and sales point. But when you look at the pixels that the human eye can actually interact with, it really doesn't matter. if it's 4K or, you know, whatever you're looking at, it just doesn't really matter, because your human eye has only so many megapixels that it can relate to and it can process.
Sure.
But I think it's definitely interesting from a marketing PR standpoint, where you're marketing towards the EYE to the EGO. Because at this point, you're not even targeting the eyes.
Yeah.
You're targeting the ego. So as long as you can say, oh, I've got this new 4K, blah, 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 then I think you're winning. And I mean, it's cheaper for companies to produce, you know, larger screen TVs. We all know that. And, you know, that's interesting as well. But as far as gaming, I do play a bit, and I get a lot of opportunity to play at GDC when I go, and I go every year. So that's always fantastic. But yeah, that to answer your question, that's always my question with 4K. Does it really matter when you compare it to what your human capabilities are?
Yeah, and probably would matter a lot more if you're talking about like a 100-foot, you know, like a gigantic wall-sized screen. 4K resolution actually comes in very handy. When you're talking about a 50-inch screen, 55-inch screen that everybody already has, I'm guessing the difference are somewhat marginal, but you never know. And Sony appears to be kind of building towards that. But speaking of the PlayStation VR, back when Sony announced the PlayStation VR, they dropped they released the $400 price tag on the setup. On this show, after it was announced, Mike Murphy from Quartz did point out that the $400 got you the goggles, the viewer, but the rest of the gear would cost extra. Well, now Sony is saying, and here it is a few days later, that yes, in fact, most people will want to spend the additional $100 to get the core bundle. So what was really great publicity for Sony when they announced this, that, oh my goodness, you know, VR for $400, that's really inexpensive. In reality, you know, there are some people with a PS4 that have the camera already, so they aren't going to need to drop that extra $100. But it sounds like, there's going to be a decent amount of people that the more realistic amount is $500. Do you think this was disingenuous at all, or what do you think? I mean, it was good marketing. Sony played it right, I think, in the long run, but is it going to offend people?
Well, I think that, you know, they were comparing themselves to the more expensive VR goggles, which also need like $1,000 or $1,200 computer. So, you know, that upgrade is way higher than just another $100. Mm-hmm. But they did play it off like it's only $400. Mm-hmm. I think no one ever, you know, thought you were just going to be able to buy an Oculus and not have to buy the, you know, Oculus Ready PC. They were pretty upfront about the fact that you'd also have to buy that. So, yeah, I don't know, a little bit disingenuous.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, when you think about it, you are getting virtual reality for $400 or $500. People are out here, you know, spending $1,000 on a phone that doesn't even have that capability.
Mm-hmm. Or does, but it's just in a matter of putting the phone on your face, and it's not nearly the same experience. So you were at GDC. Did you get to play around with any of the kind of VR stuff that was there?
Yeah, you know, an interesting thing for VR and just my personal experience is you guys, you know, living here in Silicon Valley, we've been kind of inundated with VR for at least the past 4 or 5 years, and people running around pitching you, and even the Oculus guys before they signed with Facebook, just, hey, you know, try this and check this out. And in between me getting sick on some of those those experiences and not getting sick and enjoying it, I've seen, you know, so many VR experiences. I'm just so excited to see it coming more mainstream.
Yeah.
So that's the part that I'm really excited about. For me, it just feels like kind of when I was wearing Google Glass. It's like, oh, that's just second nature, you know? So to see things like that becoming more mainstream and not just a tool for early adopters, I'm very excited about that.
It's pre-order start March 22nd for the PlayStation VR. All right, let's move on. Neiman Lab reports that a new NPR ethics policy says that no one on the radio station itself is allowed to mention podcasts, specifically NPR podcasts. Now, I get that this has to do with how they're funded. The local stations, the local NPR stations bring in most of the money. But this also seems like a weird sort of backward-looking policy that highlights the battle between old and new media. Liberty, I'm not just saying that because you're young. What do you think? You actually focus on technology for the millennials. So what does a story like this seem to you? I mean, you've probably been listening to podcasts. Do you think millennials really prefer podcasts to, I guess my question is, here's my question. Do millennials still listen to the regular radio ever?
that question took me back. I think it depends on where you are just in the United States, because I personally do not listen to the average radio. And it's because I'm in the Bay Area, so I'm not in a car, and you're constantly on the move, and you really want your information on demand. So one of the things that you were saying earlier was this is a conflict between old media and new media. And I think that constraint has to just completely dissipate, because once you realize there is no old media, it is just new media. You can interact with each other and understand that it doesn't make a difference where someone consumes the content. Your goal should be that they consume your content.
I also kind of feel definitely that. And I also kind of feel like NPR as a radio station is very different from a lot of other radio stations. You listen to certain radio stations and it's loud noises and check this out, look over there, flash, flash, boom, boom, boom. NPR is very much more level-headed in how they approach their media. And I think as a result, a lot of the people that actually consume their content have a certain expectation of what they get when they listen to NPR. So I almost wonder if it's also just kind of about the fact that NPR maybe knows or feels like it knows that their two audiences, their radio audience and their podcast audience, are kind of two separate audiences. And we don't, you know, I'm speaking in NPR's terms, we don't feel like we should go on the air and actively promote our things. You know what I mean? And be like, well, what you need to do now is you need to download the NPR One app, blah, 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 and you can get all our podcasts, do-ba-do-ba-do. Like, that's just, that doesn't strike me as an NPR thing. You know what I mean? So, I don't know.
Maybe two separate audiences, though? Like, do you think that
I'm not saying that I think that. I'm wondering if maybe that's how they feel, that they're, you know, that the people that do listen to the radio, like, that's how they consume NPR, and maybe they aren't as concerned with the digital side of things. And the people that listen to podcasts, they're already in the podcast world, so why would they turn on the radio? And so maybe that's why they're thinking this, you know?
Well, I mean, I think the NPR audience is traditionally old and
older.
And
older, Megan, older.
Older.
Older. So I think that's part of it. Whereas podcasts has a traditionally younger, I won't say just young, but younger audience. And like I said before, like, they get they're publicly funded too. They're different than the regular, you know, radio, because they're publicly funded. So like the people you hear on your local NPR station, they're getting money from the people that they're talking to in their communities when they are raising the money.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to me, like, you know, we don't need to go too far into the advertising debate here. I mean, we're supported by advertising, but some NPR podcasts are starting to be supported by advertising, which you didn't really hear in the past, which is interesting. So, yeah.
And in some cases, making more money in the podcast form than they are in the radio form.
Yeah.
Based on that. So.
Exactly. So,
yeah, I think that's a good point. You definitely typically don't see ads or don't have that relationship with ads on NPR. Mm-hmm. It's always from, you know, some endowment or someone left something. Like you said, it's typically the community who's listening to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But that was the same thing with PBS, where there's like, you know, it's still supported by advertising. You know, when you watch Sesame Street, there's still like some ads.
I guess in Jason's version of advertisement, his, hey, come on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I do it on the side, you know, radio voice. All right. Rumor time. Apple has their big announcement coming up next week, Monday. Megan, you're going to be on set at 10 a.m. Pacific with Leo Laporte and Alex Lindsay to cover the announcement. So definitely be sure to tune in. That'll be live at twit.tv/live at 10 a.m. Pacific. But what do we think Apple will unveil? Mark Gurman, a 9-to-5 Mac, usually knows these things. He's very good at it by now. And so basically, he kind of gave a quick rundown of things that we should be looking forward to. I wonder if you guys are excited about these. The first up, of course, is what we've been hearing a lot about over the past few weeks, the iPhone SE. That would be the enhanced or special edition 4-inch iPhone. Basically, taking the iPhone 5S external, you know, kind of body of the 5S and upgrading the internals in a bunch of different ways with Apple Pay, A9 chip, M9 chip, better 12 megapixel camera, no 3D touch. Is this speaking to either of you, this particular phone? It sounds like actually a pretty nice phone for someone who wants a smaller device.
I agree with that. It definitely sounds like a great phone. I'm not going to be in line for it, but it sounds like a great phone.
Yeah, you're an Android user, right, Liberty?
I am a Fandroid. That is correct.
Okay. Yeah.
I am too.
I am not.
We outnumber you today, Megan.
But yeah, the smaller, for me personally, the smaller isn't interesting, but it's interesting that that they would go back to smaller, just not the smaller, not just the smaller iPhone, but the smaller iPad too.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not interesting to me personally, but that was a lot of people's complaint. The iPad Pro, I love all the features, but it's just too big.
13-inch tablet is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for all these things that are coming out or not coming out, I'm more interested in the fact that they decided to hold this the day before their hearing, which I know we've talked about up and down on this show. But I'm curious if they're going to include that in the presentation that they give. It's smaller. It's not this year. They're not having it in the Moscone Center in San Francisco. They're having it, you know, on their headquarters. If they're going to take a time to just really speak to their core press that they've invited and give a statement that they want the press to share.
Man, if they do, I would have to imagine, like I couldn't imagine an Apple event where they start off or even where they finish with, and one final thing. You know this thing that we've been talking about with the FBI and on encryption and backdoors and blah, blah, blah. Let's tell you something. Like Tim Cook actually just had a very big interview with, was it Time Magazine? Very interesting read. Definitely worth checking out. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel after that, after reading that, kind of feel like that's the talk that they would have had at the event. I bet we don't hear about it.
Yeah, I
don't
know.
Have to agree with that. I think the conference is only going to be about the technology and only about them releasing. I don't think they're going to mention the FBI or the case at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think my guess is they're going to make vague references to it.
Maybe to the security of the iPhone or something very like loosely touching on the borders of you know, the security feature and stuff. But yeah, directly addressing it, I'm going to go ahead and bet no at this point.
Well, after
that's my wager.
That's your wager.
Who's going to throw some money on the table?
I actually think they're going to do something that we can't even imagine because they're the smartest marketing people there are. And they have literally been working the press. I mean, we talk to people who say, like, I get emails from them every day. You know, they've been working this whole time. Yes, they care about our privacy, but they also have been taking many opportunities to make their point with the press.
For sure.
The people that they know, the people that they invite to this event, which the people that they know absolutely are on their side.
For sure. So. We're probably going to see a bunch of articles about how they didn't talk about it.
Yeah, and isn't it great that they didn't talk about it? Yeah.
And just real quick, you mentioned it briefly, but just so people know, 9.7-inch iPad Pro is the iPad Pro version that we're probably going to see. And then also, I guess, rumors are pointing to possibly more models of the Apple Watch ahead of the big Apple Watch refresh later this year. And more bands, if Apple Watch bands floats your boat. There you go.
Mm-hmm. All right. After the break, we will talk about the open source movement at Microsoft. But first, let's take a minute to thank Wealthfront, the sponsor of this episode. You know that investing your money is the smart thing to do. It's like flossing or deleting useless photos off your smartphone or cleaning out your gutter. You got to do it. But where to start? Move investing to the top of your to-do list and try Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees between 1% and 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, and no hidden fees. That's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. You can get started investing today with as little as $500. It only takes a few minutes to sign up at Wealthfront.com, and it goes right to work monitoring your portfolios around the clock and taking action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront portfolios are based on modern portfolio theory and are designed to adjust according to your personal risk tolerance while staying diversified and tax efficient. Wealthfront is transparent and accessible. You can view all your accounts in one place, whether they're personal, joint, or retirement. You can also see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard, on your desktop, or with their mobile app. They have simplified their risk identification process, which allows you to begin investing sooner. With Wealthfront's new portfolio review, you can see if your portfolio is at risk, how diversified your investments are, what you are losing to fees, even minimize your taxes, all for free. Wealthfront manages over $2.6 billion in client assets, and it's growing rapidly every day. Invest in your future with Wealthfront. Visit Wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many Twit fans who have seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today at Wealthfront.com/TNT.
All right, so Microsoft has had a change of heart recently when it comes to kind of open source software, if you hadn't noticed anyways. Joining us to talk all about this is Scott Hanselman, longtime blogger and podcaster on all sorts of topics from open source to 3D printing, as well as some of his work at Microsoft on .NET and Azure. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Hey, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We really appreciate getting you on here. So we've got a couple of things that we thought we could talk to you about. First of all, a topic that seems to be just kind of all over the place right now is, like I said, Microsoft and its newfound friendliness to open source software. First, I guess maybe we can start with kind of explaining a little bit about what Microsoft has demonstrated as far as its openness to open source lately. It's done a few kind of cool things.
Sure, sure. So first thing, appropriate disclaimer, this is Scott Hanselman, individual person, not a spokesman of Microsoft. I'm not a marketer. I'm not an evangelist. I'm just a person who was an open source person before. And actually, I went to Microsoft 8 years ago to work on open source. I was doing open source in banking. I was doing open source in .NET as early as 1999 and 2000. I was doing open source in Java before then. And when Scott Guthrie approached me and said, "Hey, we're doing some amazing stuff with .NET. Come and work at Microsoft, and you know, let's open source some things." This was a long time ago. People don't remember that actually the .NET runtime was released as what's called shared source to universities as early as 2001. So while it feels like everything changed like last month, it's been one of those things where you push this rock up the hill and we're just getting some traction and now it's falling down the other side. But it's been kind of 14 years in the making.
So has the PR changed a little bit? I mean, have they felt like it's more important to push this side to make this more obvious to people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not PR, and I would have to say, knowing that the person that I work for, there's actually like a layer of Scots. Because I'm Scott Hanselman, there's Scott Hunter, and there's Scott Guthrie. Scott's all the way down.
Scott's of Microsoft. Yes.
And there isn't like active PR around open source. It's more just if you show up and you do stuff and you do it correctly, the open source community appreciates it. You know, if you put the .NET framework out there and you say, "Hey, it runs on Linux. Go and see what you can do with it." And then the next thing you know, some 15-year-old girl in Denmark decides to get it running on a PlayStation 2. And it's like, "Wow, why'd you do that?" "Because it's amazing and it's open source." That's the whole point. That's exactly how it's supposed to work. So I think with the advent of the cloud, this is my opinion, that's how Microsoft can make money, right? Mm-hmm. You might have a Mac, you might have an iPhone, you know, I have an iPhone, but I can run Office 365 on it. I can talk to the Azure cloud, which might run Node.js. But if we succeed, maybe you'll use .NET and you'll have fun, and you know, maybe you'll use Python. It doesn't really matter because we've got a cloud for you to run it in. That's the general thinking.
Sure.
But I want us to, you know, promote .NET because that's the language in the world that I love.
So I would say that the kind of view, at least what's really kind of opened my eyes, has been the news that was very recent, which is that Microsoft, you know, has its SQL Server for Linux now, which in that regard, okay, so maybe open source has been kind of a long time pushing the rock up over the mountain, and now it's falling over the other side. But kind of announcing products on the Linux side of things does feel like something very new. Why do you think that now?
Well, I think that I have always felt that reality, when it comes to software development, is a hybrid. The idea that a company would be all Microsoft all the time and exclusively Microsoft isn't the case. You know, you might run ASP.NET on a web server, and then you have Linux for caching, and you've got some other thing for a database. The reality is people mix and match. You have an iPhone, you have a PlayStation, you have a Windows machine. So why not enable people to do that? So having SQL Server on Linux means, hey, great, we can have SQL Server on people who already have Linux. But in the past, if they were on all Windows shop, the conversation stops. There's no SQL Server at all. So it's about choice, right? Mm-hmm. It's about making sure that people do what they want to do, where they want to do it. Any app, anywhere, you know, any developer.
Sure, sure. I have to imagine the answer to this is very, but in your own words, how instrumental do you feel Satya Nadella has been kind of in this move? I mean, you know, it sounds like what you're saying is pre-Satya, there was already kind of a movement in this direction, but it really does feel like things have accelerated now. How instrumental is Satya to that?
Well, I can't speak to his mind, but I can say that having met with him a number of times, he's a very kind of lean back and thoughtfully listen and take in, absorb all the information from different locations and then make decisions. But it's also worth pointing out that he has a background in the cloud, right? He came up through the Azure and the cloud side of Microsoft. Mm-hmm. So he's thinking cloud first, mobile first as a person. That's how it's in his DNA to think about how are mobile people going to do this and how are they going to access the cloud. So it makes sense that he would pivot things in that direction.
So Microsoft Build is coming up in a couple of weeks, and you're going to be speaking at it. What did we expect to see at Build?
We are going to see all sorts of stuff with .NET and ASP.NET. We've actually got three sessions in a row where my boss and some of my colleagues are going to talk about .NET Core, which is a little version of .NET that people can run on Linux and Mac and on Windows. And we'll talk a little bit about Visual Studio Code. So like if anyone who's listening likes using like Sublime Text or needs a great text editor, Visual Studio Code is an editor that they can use. And we're going to show people how to get started in like 10 minutes. Like in the old days, you want to use .NET? Well, let's download a 2 gigabyte ISO and then, you know, reboot. Now it's going to be 10 minutes. Let's get started. Let's do some Hello Worlds. And then can we go from Hello World and scale into the cloud and make huge applications? So I like to call it the grow-up story, right? Yeah. How do I teach a 15-year-old how to do Hello World? And then a couple weeks later, they're building cloud applications that have a global scale. And that isn't just like, that's not marketing. That is totally possible to do that. I've done hackathons and we've achieved that.
Well, it's a big part of what you are actually engaged with recently. Well, you were just telling us about marches for makers.com, which is another kind of angle of how you are educating people that don't have a whole lot of experience, let's say, with some of these tools and empowering them to do really cool things. Tell us a little bit about Marches for Makers.
So, I get in trouble because I do a lot of stuff on the side.
You really do. You've got your hands full, I have to say.
I got a whole side gig. If the Microsoft thing doesn't work out, I'll fall back on that and making arcade machines. So Marches for Makers is a partnership that I'm doing with my friend Saran Yitbarek, and she does CodeNewbies.org. So CodeNewbies is this really great community of people who are very welcoming towards getting started in software. And we think that hardware is just a great way to get people excited about making stuff. So last year we started Marches for Makers, and all month long we do Google Hangouts and podcasts and blog posts and interviews across both of our blogs and both of our podcasts. And we don't always succeed, but we try to have new content every single day throughout the month of March. And we've got some amazing interviews with people who built Mars rovers. And I talked with a woman who's an electrical engineer from Aero.com. And I talked to a captain at the U.S. Cyberspace Security Department who does making in his spare time. So if you're interested in getting started and, you know, making an LED blink, like you can go to Marches for Makers. We've got Google Hangouts. Whoop, that's not actually plugged in. But and try it, you know. We did a thing recently where we spent an hour going from unboxing a Raspberry Pi until getting an LED to blink. And I tell you, when you have that experience, that moment when an LED blinks, it's like, I did that. I blinked the hell out of that LED.
You know what, Scott? I think the really cool thing that Marches for Makers does is reach out to such a diverse community. It's not just the kind of customary people that you would see working on a Raspberry Pi or transforming a particular product. Can you tell us a bit about the community that you're reaching out to and the people that you're targeting?
Yeah, actually a good example for the people who are running the websites in the background there and showing them, if you go to HanselMinutes.com, which is one of the podcasts that's working on Marches for Makers, and you go to the archives page, you're going to see this wall of faces. And the faces look like what I think we want America to look like. And the argument that it's hard to find people of varying backgrounds doing great work in technology, it's just not true. They're out there. You just got to go and ask them to come on your show. And you notice that this isn't 5 or 10 people. This is 500 episodes of great technical content. You see the same thing at Code Newbies. We've got people from all over the world, all ages, all classes, all colors, doing amazing stuff with technology. So we just want to showcase that and get people excited about it because, you know, when a Raspberry Pi Zero is $9, everybody should be a software engineer.
Definitely. Yeah, so, that's one thing I definitely like about that is it's not your purpose isn't focused on age or race or anything like that. It's really just solely focused on technology. So good job.
Yep, exactly. All comers. If you're doing cool stuff, then you should be celebrated.
That is really cool. Marchesformakers.com. And I have to ask you, before we let you go, you've got an awesome MAME cabinet back there.
Is that something that you've instructed people on how to build?
Yep. If you go out and Google with Bing for Hanselman arcade cabinet, then you'll find a 7-part series that I did on how to make it. I actually refurbished an old cabinet. I built that whole control panel from scratch. This is done entirely from scratch right here.
Excellent.
I've got vinyl in the back. I painted the whole thing. It's really easy to make. It's about $300 and you do it in a weekend.
That's really cool. I have a kind of an ongoing project of a tabletop version of this. It's taking a little bit of extra time to do it, but I cannot wait. And I'm very envious of the full-size stand-up. It looks really good.
It is super exciting.
Yeah.
I recommend it to everyone. And it's really not hard. I mean, it's just a big box and some lights. And you see like the you see the little USB deals there? Actually, you don't know that they're USB deals. Those are the coin slots. I plugged them into the keyboard thing because I needed 5 volts to make them light up. So I'm like, where can I get 5 volts? So I shoved it into the USB port and it lit up. And I'm like, all right, that won't cause a fire.
I noticed that you're missing a rollerball, so no Marble Madness. That's okay, though. I'll forgive you.
Priorities straight. This is more of a Street Fighter situation.
All right. Fair enough.
Built this from scratch. You outline one thing. He doesn't have.
Hey, what can I say? Marble Madness is like one of my favorite all-time games. It's like my eyes are drawn to it.
That's the kind of people and technology that pull everyone else back. Well, actually, where's the rollerball?
The one thing you did. Yes, you're right. Man, I suck. I'm sorry. Awesome stuff. Scott, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I guess you've got a lot of stuff going on, so I'm not really quite sure what to point people to, but tell people in your own words where you want them to follow your work online.
I think if you check out Hanselman.com, also sometimes if you Google for just Scott, it's either me or Scott Toilet Paper.
So okay.
Depending on what your needs are, you can possibly find me or some tissue. So try that out. But yeah, check me out at Hanselman.com. Follow me on Twitter. I've got lots of great stuff going on. We've got open source. We've got hacking. We've got software. I do diabetes stuff in software. I've got Legos. And just, you know, check me out because it's all free. It's all side stuff that I just enjoy. I'm so excited. I just want to tell everyone about it. So yeah, engage with me and let's build some stuff together.
That's fantastic. And if you're going to Microsoft Build at the end of the month, definitely check out Scott's talks there.
I will
as well.
Be at the Chipotle across the street.
Excellent. Be careful.
And I want to say one thing as well. Scott has got to be the funniest developer you will ever follow online. He tweets and posts all the time, and he makes 140 characters seem like a stand-up show. He is hilarious.
Excellent.
It's great.
Excellent.
It's so sweet.
Then I guess the Twitter deciding to keep at 140 characters isn't going to affect your humor very much because you're already very used to it at this point.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Scott Hanselman, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. All right. Up next, Microsoft held a party at the Game Developer Conference. And let's just say it's made for a somewhat awkward post-party hangover. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, ScoreBig. What's the next big event that you want to attend? A musical, maybe Wicked, a Black Sabbath concert, maybe an NBA game. Maybe you want to bring the whole family to the Black Sabbath concert. Probably not, but maybe instead Frozen on Ice. Maybe you want to get all dressed up in blue paint and see the Blue Man Group, or grow a super long beard and rock out to ZZ Top, or class the place up. The New York City Philharmonic. Whatever it is, you can bet that there's a way to pay less for better seats. How? Just go to scorebig.com. 40% of all live event tickets go unsold. ScoreBig is making it easy to attend live events by working directly with your favorite teams and artists to get their unsold seats at unpublished prices. At scorebig.com, you're always guaranteed huge savings. You'll pay much less than what the box office charges for tickets. They have incredible deals on tickets to concerts, sports games, Broadway productions, family-friendly events. And you can take advantage of these by going to scorebig.com. You'll find the event and the seats that you want. And then you can make an offer with ScoreBig's name a ticket price feature. You'll get an answer from ScoreBig instantly, and you can save up to 60% on your tickets. You also have an option, of course, to pay a fixed price, which is much less expensive than major online ticket resellers. Now, with ScoreBig, there are no surprise fees. You'll get free shipping, and you can even favorite your shows, the shows that you want to see eventually, and be notified on upcoming dates to attend those shows or events, which is absolutely a convenient feature. Now, quit overpaying for tickets. Get the tickets you want at prices you can afford with ScoreBig. Next time you're planning to go to a game or a show, visit ScoreBig first and see how much you can save. That's scorebig.com. then you'll want to click on the microphone and enter promo code TNT to save an extra $20 off your first ticket purchase. That's scorebig.com, promo code TNT. And we thank ScoreBig for their support.
Microsoft had some bad PR today as photos from an Xbox event they held at the Game Developers Conference hit the internet. Matt Weinberger from Business Insider wrote about this story and is joining us from San Francisco. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So there were scantily clad cheerleaders dancing on podiums at the event, and they were apparently also paid to socialize with people in the crowd. What do we know about this?
Yeah, so this is actually not that weird for GDC parties, unfortunately. They went to a party. I believe it was invite only, but don't quote me on that. And it's supposed to be for everyone. And dancers up on podiums, they're paid to mingle. And the sad part is that this isn't that weird for GDC. It's happened in years past, almost every single year that I can think of. The only difference is that in the past, it's been small startups. This is the first time where it's been Microsoft, if you know what I mean.
Wow. Yeah. Liberty, yeah. Liberty, you were at the GDC. You were not invited to this event.
I don't want to say that I wasn't invited, but I will say that I didn't attend.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. That's it.
Thank
Might have been
you.
For the best.
Yes. So,
yeah, I would have to agree with him. I've been to GDC for many, many years. And this to me, I couldn't believe it was such a huge story. It's so common. It is
That's
typically
right.
every single year this happens. And I remember a few years ago, and you probably remember this too, when it was Yetison, you know, when
That's
Yetison
right.
was on the chopping block for, you know, having women and all these things there. And they had gymnasts at their event.
That's right.
And it wasn't the cheerleader thing. It was gymnast. So every year it's something. I honestly, like I said, I couldn't believe it was such a huge story. But it's so common for GDC.
The only thing that makes it such a big unusual deal, because like I said, first off, it's the first time that it's been a company of Microsoft size. And Microsoft specifically has made being more inclusive a major goal. You know, Satya Nadella, Microsoft's CEO, he recently was boasting about how he's made it mandatory for every Microsoft employee to have training in unconscious bias. And even at GDC itself, they sponsored a luncheon for women in gaming. You know what I mean? So it's like on the one hand, they're saying, hey, we want more women in tech. And on the other hand, they're saying, if you come to a party with our name on it, here are some scantily clad dancers.
But you know what, Matt? I got to say this. When you say it has to do with inclusion, you know, I hear, mm-hmm. Why were there no male dancers? I
that's
don't
right.
hear why are there female dancers. I'm like, okay, that's fine.
But
inclusion. I'm like, where are the male dancers? Where was it?
That's right.
Hole? Yeah.
That's exactly right. And it's also like, yeah. And then the other thing, and something which I've seen a lot, and this is kind of the unfortunate part with the that I've seen on Twitter, is that it's the dancers who are getting a lot of the backlash,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't seem to be fair at all to me.
Right.
They were doing their job, right? The problem is that Microsoft says, you know, here's our big open to everyone party. And as you say, it's women dancers. So who's this party for, right?
Yes. Well, you know what? When you look at the photos, and I'm sure everybody's seen the photos online, to me, they look like a shot glass girl or somebody you'd go into a regular bar and kind of see dressed like that. So I don't think it was anything different in their attire. It just looks like you would go to a bar. But I totally get what you're saying, Matt, is that this event was sponsored by a major company. And that could be the difference between a few years ago with the Edison situation.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
That's exactly right. And it ain't classy. You know, like I've been to lots of tech parties in my time, and somehow none of them there's been entertainment, and somehow very few of them have had dancers of any kind, let alone the kind
elevated dancers. Yeah,
that's exactly right. You know,
right.
So I feel like I get that they were trying to do something fun, but there's ways to have fun without making people uncomfortable.
Well, yeah, and everyone can correct me if I'm wrong. I really feel like the last year has been hyper awareness around kind of just inclusion, sexism in the tech industry, all that kind of stuff. When a company that's small, that doesn't know any better, does this, I'm not saying that it's necessarily forgivable, but you can kind of understand
why they made that choice for good or for bad. But this is a company that we all know of. You know, Microsoft is a huge company, has plenty of employees, and has to think about how their employees might interpret something like this. Because I have to imagine their employees were at this party, and some of their employees are, you know, are people who are, would be offended by this. Or, you know, I mean, they have to think about how their employees would feel. And I don't know, like, I just think right now, I think what you said was right. It's kind of tone deaf for this particular time. Yep. You would think that Microsoft, as a large corporation, would have learned enough to know different, you know better to do something different.
That's exactly right. And it's just that Microsoft especially, like, no one at no point in the planning process did anyone say, hey, maybe this isn't a great idea. So what does that tell you about the process with this? And as you say, just Microsoft has the resources. They have, you know, they do all kinds of work with women in tech groups here in Silicon Valley. You'd think that someone somewhere might have heard something
a little bit
somewhere on the grapevine.
Yeah. Well,
they said maybe this isn't a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, I freelanced for Microsoft for many years, and they were a great company. They were very supportive of women. I worked mostly for women. Like, I didn't have any issues. Xbox is and always has been, like, a separate, sort of separate part.
Right.
So we keep saying Microsoft, but this was Xbox.
Sure.
Also, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure they probably outsourced this party to an agency that planned this. So, yes, I mean, shame on them for, like, not picking a better agency. But they have also apologized. And
approving the plan of the agency, because I have to imagine they went over the details.
I mean, I think that Phil Spencer, the head of Xbox who issued the apology, I think his apology was about as good as apologies come, insofar as he didn't try to equivocate on whether or not it was the agency. He just said, you know, whoever did it, whether it was an agency or not, it's Microsoft's name on the banners at the party, right? So the fact that Spencer, the Xbox boss, took full responsibility and said, sorry, we messed up, I think that says a lot about how seriously Microsoft takes this, if nothing else. Other people have, just judging from my Twitter feed today, have taken it differently. But, you know, I think it was a positive step.
Well, I want to get back to one point that you mentioned before, that the dancers are the ones getting all the negative feedback, and you apparently also on Twitter. I think that is so often the case, and it's just, I mean, it's not even a surprise anymore. But
No. There
was the one person, the one developer that posted the Instagram picture, I think, that went viral, that just said, like, having a great time at the GDC, and it had the pictures of these women. And I went to that Instagram picture fully expecting to have, like, the, you know, just the general vitriol that you see when something like this happens and everyone gloms on. There was almost nothing. There was almost nothing to this man, you know, for posting these pictures. Because, you know, sometimes it works both ways. Really angry people, angry at someone's sexism. But it didn't. And then it's just another example of when things go down, women often bear the bigger brunt of the online hate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's just, and even in my Twitter mentions, whatever, the reaction from people who were upset with it wasn't like upset pitchforks and fires upset. It was more like, oh, here we go again, upset, or this keeps happening, upset. You know, it becomes a big deal almost because it isn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. Some people are drawing their line in the sand.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the very first time I talked to you, Matt, was last year at GDC, and we were talking about how it was a more inclusive environment. There were more, you know, it was like just hot on the heels of Gamergate, so there was a lot more.
Well, so here's a true story from GDC that I thought was really cool. So it was actually, they really doubled down on the inclusion this year. Like, the event in general, I thought was great from that front. And, like, I don't know if you've ever been to San Francisco's Moscone Convention Center, but right by the bathrooms, there's this giant wall where local businesses advertise. And, like, I would say 3/5 of those are ads for strip clubs, right? And this year, GDC's organizers put a giant black curtain up in front of those ads, so that way congoers wouldn't have to look at them.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not the story getting headlines, but that is a good story. Thank you.
Yeah. So GDC as a whole, I would say, has been making positive strides, which is another reason why Microsoft's party was such a disappointment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Liberty, having been there for several years?
Do I agree that Microsoft's party was...
No, the GDC is making positive strides.
Well, I definitely think so. I had the opportunity to actually host and organize an event. I did a luncheon for Blacks in Gaming, And I organized that launching on Wednesday. And it was interesting because out of everyone, this was our second annual luncheon, and it was only one female who attended my Blacks and Gaming luncheon, and I was that person. So I was the only one who attended. And last year, it was very, very exciting because there was probably like five or six that attended. But overall, outside of the particular luncheon that I organized, I saw so many different people from all different walks of life, and I saw a lot of people cross mingling one segment, because a lot of people, as you know, in gaming, they try to segment themselves from designers or people who are working, you know, on the front end or whatever they're focused on. And I saw a lot of inclusiveness and inclusion, and definitely more women outside of that particular space. So I think you're absolutely right. There is definitely a trend going at GDC, as well as many other tech conferences like Google I/O, whatever you want to focus on. Definitely.
Yep.
Well, Matt, thank you so much. I know you've written a whole lot this week. You've written about a Marvel app. You've written about Universal Windows Platform. Is there anything else that we should tell people about?
Have you already talked about the Gawker verdict?
No, we haven't talked about the Gawker verdict.
Yes. Well, briefly, the jury found against Gawker in its Hulk Hogan sex trial, which is, you know, that news is all of an hour old. So it remains to be seen how that's going to play out. But that's going to be sending some shockwaves for a while.
Yeah. Ryan, you've written about that, or you will write about
that?
Yes. Awesome.
Yes, I have written about it.
All right.
Yes,
so check that out at businessinsider.com. And Matt is at Gamoid. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Take care, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
Bye.
All right, TNT's fan of the day is Ronald Fisher at RonFisher67 on Twitter, who sent us this picture of a massive TNT saying, quote, "Twit on all day at work, 4 55-inch curved TVs in a nice matrix." That's where 4K comes in handy right there. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, Facebook. You got one on Snapchat. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT. We're going to find it. The problem with getting it on Snapchat is you look at it and you go, oh, that's great. I want to put that in the show. Wait a minute. Where'd it go?
Well, no, I tried to screenshot it, and then I had a screenshot fail where I was like, and then also when you screen, I mean, Liberty, you know this, when you screenshot something, then the person gets a notification that you screenshot, and it's not the coolest thing to do.
In this case, I would think they would understand.
If you're going to Snapchat me a picture, I will screenshot it. Just know that.
Yeah.
After the break, the only thing standing between you and a puppy might be Twitter. Find out why. But first, let's take a minute to thank Prosper. They are the sponsor of this episode. Now, if you don't want to get stuck with high-interest rate credit cards, go to Prosper.com. Prosper's online marketplace connects people who need money with those who want to invest. Invest in you. It's like Uber or Airbnb, but for borrowing money. You can use Prosper to borrow up to $35,000 in as few as 5 days. With Prosper.com, you can borrow money for just about anything you want. You can pay off high-rate credit cards. You can fix up your house, even plan a vacation. Anything you want, it's your money. Maybe you want to remodel your kitchen or bathroom, make some much-needed repairs on your house, add an outdoor deck just in time for spring. What about new furniture or appliances? I've been eyeing that Samsung smart fridge since we saw it at CES in January. A Prosper loan could help. Prosper.com is the better way to get the cash you need at a low interest rate. To check your low rate instantly without affecting your good credit, go to Prosper.com/TNT. For up to $35,000 in your account in as few as 5 days, go to Prosper.com/TNT. That's Prosper.com/TNT. So Motherboard, the magazine online, is known for delving into the darker sides of the web. But today they had a lighter story about one dad who learned a valuable lesson about not underestimating his daughter's power on Twitter. 17-year-old Clara Foster asked her dad for a puppy. He said no. Now, some parents make kids promise they'll pick up after the dog or remember to feed it or take it for walks. But Clara's dad said all she had to do to prove she was responsible enough to get this puppy was to have her retweeted 100,000 times.
Well, originally he said 1 million.
He did say 1 million. He backed it up. And he admitted that he's not that technically savvy. So there's the tweet. That's the actual puppy that she got. And thanks to you people out there who retweeted, she will get her puppy.
We can all sleep tonight.
That's the best story.
Apparently this works.
I get. Well, the dad said his lesson was he's not going to do that again. He's not going
to. You don't make deals. You don't make deals.
Not about retweets.
As a parent of very young children, I already know you don't make deals. Deals will be the end of you.
This is one of the retweets I'd be behind. But you guys know when you're on Twitter and you see those, oh, my dad said if I get this and, you know, if I get 50,000 likes on my Facebook page, I can go on this. That's annoying. That's completely annoying. Everybody's been doing that since we've had it. But when there's a dog involved,
right,
I will retweet it from every account that I have. That is the best. I love it.
Right.
Wow.
I feel like I've seen this a lot, like you were saying, Liberty, on Facebook. Not as much on Twitter. For whatever reason, I'm not really quite sure.
Typically, the charities that do it.
Yeah. I suppose so.
Retweeted, we'll donate a dollar to ABC. But typically, when it comes to the personal family, you're right. It's definitely Facebook, and they're always holding the sign, kind of like, you know, internet panhandling sort of thing.
Yeah. It worked for a while. It doesn't pull me in anymore.
No, with a puppy, you're right. A puppy is something different. But yeah, where it says, like, you know, don't scroll through this before saying amen, like those kinds of things. Like, it's too much.
That is the easiest way to get unfriended, just to let you know. I will unfriend you, definitely.
Yeah, it is an interesting, social media. And again, we already know, like, how you're gamifying the system. Like, it's obvious to us, so... the dad learned a valuable lesson, and now the girl is 17. So, like, who's going to be taking care of that dog? The dad is, and the mom, not the girl who's going to be leaving home soon.
I mean, the dad didn't totally lose. He gets a puppy.
He does. He gets.
Just going to say the dad won.
Uh-huh.
The
he did.
Dad
yeah.
A puppy.
Right.
He just doesn't know that he needed the puppy yet. Yeah.
There you go.
Will soon when the puppy actually becomes his because his daughter isn't taking care of it anymore. Then he'll realize he needed that puppy all
along. Family puppy.
Yeah. Yes. Well, Liberty, thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing all of your knowledge. Where's the best place? Where are several of the best places to keep up with everything that you're doing?
Yeah, to keep up with me, again, thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And to keep up with me, you can find me at Liberty Madison on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Whatever your poison is, that's where I am at. It's at Liberty Madison everywhere, and I would love to Snapchat you, so add me, and let's talk about technology, startups, and, you know, do all that fun stuff for millennials.
Fantastic. Liberty Madison, thank you so much, that tech girl. We'll see you later.
Take care.
Thank you, guys.
All right, bye. All right, Monday's guest will be Scott Johnson, returning to the show from the Frog Pants Network. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC. At twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a voicemail. Keep it short, 260-TNT-SHOW. And you can hit us up on Twitter. We are at TechNewsTodayTV.
You can subscribe to the show at twit.tv/TNT. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Kara Cole, and all the folks, every single one of them who help us produce the show every single day. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We will see you on Monday. Have a great weekend, folks. Bye.